This is the first day of this Rohatsu January 2008 Sesshin. And we're going to start the Sesshin by reading from and commenting on the autobiography of a great Chinese master, Han Shan. He was born in 1545. And don't know when he died. Find out, maybe. This is a piece that is one of the pieces that Roshi Kaplow used to read from every year or so in Taisho back in the 70s when there were far, far fewer Zen texts that have been translated into English. And I have perhaps a little bit of a sentimental fondness for this piece. I can hear him every paragraph as I read it. I can, as I read it to myself, I can hear his voice reading this. But it's quite a remarkable story. And it begins, I was born in the county of Nanjing. My mother, a pious Buddhist, had been a worshiper of the all-merciful Kuan Yin all her life, Kanon. One day she dreamed that the all-merciful mother brought into the house a child which she received with warm embraces. As a result, she became pregnant. And on the 12th of October, 1545, I was born. Sounds very close to an immaculate conception. But no, that couldn't be. In 1546, when I was 12 months old, a serious illness carried me to the point of death. My mother prayed to Kanon and vowed that if I recovered, she would offer me to the monastery to become a monk. When I did recover, she duly enlisted my name in the local Monastery of Longevity. So I guess it's a little like being betrothed. You sign something, and then you're committed to having your child then join the monastery when he is of age. When I was 3 years old, I preferred to sit alone and did not care to play with the other children. My grandfather would always exclaim, "This child is like a wooden pole." When I was 7 years old, my mother sent me to school. At that time, I had an uncle who loved me very much. One day, just before I arrived home from school, he died. When I saw him lying so still on the bed, my mother tried to deceive me about his death, saying, "Your uncle is asleep. You might wake him up." Whereupon, I called to my uncle a few times, but he didn't answer. At this, my aunt, greatly grief-stricken, cried out to him, "Oh, my heaven, where have you gone?" Very puzzled, I said to my mother, "My uncle's body lies right here. Why does my aunt say he has gone away?" Then my mother said, "Your uncle is dead." And I asked her, "If one dies, where does one then go?" And from that moment, this question was deeply impressed on my mind. After some time, my aunt gave birth to a child. When my mother took me to see the newborn baby for the first time, I asked, "How did this baby get into the belly of my aunt?" My mother patted me and said, "Foolish child, how did you get into my belly?" It's always good to, when you're cornered, to answer within the question. From that day on, the big question of life and death obsessed my thought. It stuck in my mind and weighed like lead on my heart. You know, as I read this, I'm reminded of how many other great masters suffered losses like this at a very tender age. Dogen, Zen Master Dogen, lost both of his parents when he was very young, and there were others. Psychologically, it is a terrible, potentially damaging thing to suffer a loss like that at that age. But spiritually, it can be something that leads to the such a strong aspiration to see through this matter of life and death that it can serve one in the most profound way. When I was 8 years old, I was boarded in the home of some relatives across the river so that I could be nearer my school. My mother forbade me to come home oftener than once a month. One day, however, I refused to return to school after my monthly holiday. When I told my mother that I could not bear to leave her, she became furious. She slapped me and chased me to the riverbank. But there I would not leave her to board the ferry boat. In a rage, my mother grabbed me by the hair, threw me into the river, and then turned homeward without once looking back. My grandmother, who was nearby, called for help, and I was saved. Finally, when I reached home, my mother exclaimed, "What's the use of keeping this trash alive? It would be better if he had drowned." After this, she beat me and tried to chase me away. Then I decided that my mother was too stern and cruel, and that henceforth I would not go home anymore. I learned later that my mother many times stood alone on the riverbank weeping. When my grandmother discovered this, she scolded her. With tears flowing down her cheeks, my mother answered, "I must make him overcome his too affectionate nature so that he can study seriously." So, was the mother simply cruel, or did she know what she was doing? When I was 9 years old, I entered the monastery to study. One day, I overheard a monk reciting the Sutra of the All-Merciful One, Kuan Yin, Kanon. Thus, I became aware that Kuan Yin could save us from all the sufferings of this world. At this realization, I became very excited and borrowed the sutra so that I might read and study it privately. On a later occasion, when I had accompanied my mother while she burned incense and made obeisance to Kuan Yin, I said, "Do you know the sutra of the Bodhisattva Kuan Yin?" My mother said, "No," whereupon I immediately recited the sutra for her. This pleased her very much, and she asked, "Where did you learn this?" For the manner and voice in which I recited the sutra were just like that of the old monk. So he must have been something of a mimic. In 1555, I was 10. My mother was pressing me so hard to study that I was unhappy about it. Things haven't changed that much since the 16th century. "Why should I study?" I asked her. "To get a position in the government," she replied. By the way, that was about the highest worldly goal in ancient China, was to become a civil servant and an official in the government. I asked, "What kind of position can I have later in the government?" Mother said, "You can start in a low position, and it's possible to rise to become prime minister." "Well, even if I become prime minister," I said, "what then?" "That's as far as one can go." "What is the use of becoming a high government official? To toil all one's life and get nothing is futile. I want to obtain something of eternal value. Han Shan, even at that age, would have been appreciative of that bumper sticker. The one who gets the most toys before dying, the one who gets the most things and the most toys before dying wins. My mother exclaimed, "Oh, a useless son like you can be nothing but a wandering monk." I asked, "What good is it to become a monk?" "A monk," she said, "is a disciple of the Buddha and can go anywhere in the world. He is a man of true freedom. Everywhere, people will give him offerings and serve him." "This seems very good to me. I should like to be a monk." My mother replied, "I'm afraid that you have no such merits." Well, she's a real doozy, isn't she? When I appeared surprised at this, my mother continued, "There have been many champion scholars in this world, but Buddhas and patriarchs do not often appear." "I have such merits," I insisted, "but I was afraid you would not let me go ahead." "If you have such merit," my mother replied, "I will let you go your way." This promise of hers I cherished in my heart. One day in 1556, when I was 11 years old, several persons wearing bamboo rain hats with carrying poles upon their shoulders approached our house. At once I asked my mother, "Who are these strangers?" "They're traveling monks," she replied. I was delighted and scrutinized them most carefully. When they had nearly reached our house, they put down their carrying poles and rested under a tree nearby. They asked us where they could find some food. My mother had them wait and immediately began preparing food for them, attending and serving them with great respect and veneration. After eating, the monks stood up, shouldered their poles, but raised only one hand to express their thanks. My mother waved them off, saying, "Please don't thank me." The monks left without uttering a word. I then said to my mother, "These monks seem impolite. They did not even say thank you, but just left." My mother explained, "If they had thanked me, I would have obtained less merit from this good deed." I then said to myself privately that their action showed the supremacy of the priesthood. This encounter encouraged me more strongly than ever in my decision to become a monk. The only obstacle was that I did not then have the opportunity. Yeah, just for those of you who may not know this, in Asia, even today, I think this is true. The merit you get from giving to a monk or a nun is diminished if he or she thanks you. That's the idea, anyway. Certainly, this is still practiced in Theravada Buddhism, where you give to the monks and there's really no response. When I was 8 years old, In 1557, I was 12. Usually, I didn't like to mingle with worldly people or take part in their affairs. Whenever my father tried to arrange a marriage for me, I stopped him at once. One day, I heard a monk from the capital say that in the monastery of Pao En lived a great master named Shi Lin. Immediately, I wanted to go see him. I asked my father for his permission, but he refused. Then I asked my mother to intercede for me. She said, "It's better to let our son follow his own wish and to help him to accomplish it." That October, I was sent to the monastery. As soon as the Grand Master saw me, he was pleased, remarking, "This boy is an unusual person. it would be a pitiful waste if he became an ordinary monk. At that time, Master Wu Qi was preaching a sutra in the monastery. The Grand Master brought me to the meeting. When Master Da Zhao Zhou saw me, he was delighted and exclaimed, "This child will become the master of humans and devas." He then patted me and asked, "Would you rather be a high officer in the government or a Buddha?" I answered, "A Buddha, of course." Then he turned to the others, saying, "We mustn't underestimate this child. He should be well educated." I have to wonder assuming this is true, what he's reporting, what these teachers saw in him at such a young age. Only he's only 12 or 13 at the time. Goes on, "Although I didn't understand a word of the lecture while I was listening to it, my heart became eager and fervent as if it knew something but could not express it in words. When I was 19, many of my friends gained honor by passing the official examination. My friends urged me to take the exam also. When Master Yun Ku heard of this, he became worried that I might be persuaded to engage in worldly affairs. So he encouraged me to practice religion and to strive for Zen. He told me many stories of the masters of the past and showed me the book called The Biographies of the Great Monks. Before I had finished reading The Life of Chong Feng, I was so moved and exalted that I sighed to myself and said, oh, this is what I would like to do. Then I made up my mind to devote my life to the Dharma. I then sought after the Grand Master to ask the Grand Master to ordain me." So then he threw himself into the practice of Zen, but found that he couldn't get anywhere. So he concentrated on reciting the name of Buddha Amida day and night without interruption. This is a practice of the Pure Land School. It's another sect of Buddhism, different from Zen or Chan. Although in China, it was sometimes combined, the two schools, Zen and Pure Land. In Pure Land, it's kind of it's a reciting practice where you just say as continuously as possible, "Namu Amida Butsu, Namu Amida Butsu." That's the Japanese. I don't know the Chinese, but it means I place my faith in the Buddha Amida. The Buddha Amida is not someone we have any historical records about, but is more of a symbolic, a representational Buddha, Buddha of infinite light. So he did that practice because he'd had too much trouble doing Zazen. And before long, he saw Buddha Amida appearing before him in a dream, sitting high in the sky in the direction of the setting sun. It's said that the Buddha Amida's dwelling place is in this so-called Western paradise. That winter, our monastery invited the Master Wu Qi to teach the philosophy of Huayan. That's yet another school of Buddhism, the Huayan school. When the lecture came to the point of the 10 mysterious gates, the eternal realm of the ocean seal, I suddenly realized the infinite and all-inclusive totality of the universe. I was so deeply impressed with a profound admiration for the founder of the Huayan school that I adopted one of his names and called myself Qing Yin. I then put my understanding before the master Wu Qi. He said to me, "Oh, so you wish to follow the path of Huayan. Good. But do you know why he called himself Qingliang, which means pure and cool? It was because he used to dwell on the Qingliang Mountain, cool in summer and icy and frozen in winter." And then Hanshan says, "From that moment, whether I was walking or standing still, I always saw before me a fantasy world of ice and snow. I then made up my mind to go and dwell on that mountain. Nothing in the world could attract me anymore. The yearning to renounce this world arose continuously within me. When I was 20, my grandmaster died. A few days before he died, he summoned all the monks in the monastery and said, 'I am now 83 years old. Very soon I'll be leaving this world. I have some 80 disciples, but the one who will carry on my work is Hanshan.'" He was only 20 at the time. "After my death, you should all obey his orders and not neglect his injunctions just because of his age." And then his master, wearing his formal dress, called each monk into his own room to say goodbye. All of us were much surprised by this action. 3 days later, he settled his affairs and made his will. At the time, he seemed to have only a slight illness. We took him some medicine, but he refused it, saying, "I am going away. What is the use of taking drugs?" Then he summoned all the monks in the monastery and asked them to recite the name of Buddha Amida for him. We prayed thus for 5 days and nights. With his rosary in hand, he died in the sitting posture, peacefully reciting the name of Buddha Amida. Not long after his death, the room in which he had lived for 30 years was destroyed by fire, as if to give an omen to his followers. In October of the same year, Master Yun Ku opened up a meditation assembly. I think we could just assume that this is basically a sesshin. But in China and Korea, unlike Japan, in China and Korea, they would have these much longer retreats that were less intensive than our 7-day sesshins, but or much longer, 90 days was kind of standard. He called together 53 nationally known elders in order to reveal and propagate the teaching of meditation through its actual practice. With the recommendation of Master Yun Ku, I was able to join the assembly. Now, this is where it gets into his really digging into what we would call real Zen practice. "At first, I didn't know how to work and was greatly disturbed by my ignorance. After burning incense and offering it to the master, I asked him for instruction. He first taught me how to work on the koan of 'Who is the one who recites the name of Buddha Amida?'" Here's where you see the fusion of Zen and Pure Land, where there's the basic question, the basic formula of I place my faith in the Buddha Amida, but then the Zen twist, which is, who is that Buddha? "I concentrated for the next 3 months on working on this koan without a single distracting thought." You know, we'll hear as we go along, some of these things tax our credibility, without a single distracting thought for 3 months. "It was as if I were absorbed in a dream. During this whole period, I was not aware of anyone in the assembly or of anything happening around me. But in the first few days of my striving, I was much too anxious and impatient. My impatience caused the growth of a carbuncle on my back, which swelled to a large size and was acutely inflamed. Just to pause here and comment, this is one of the great obstacles of practice, is impatience, which really means grasping, having this goal in one's mind, stuck in one's mind, and grasping to reach it. The whole point of the practice is to get out of future thought, thinking about the future, and just settle deeply into this very moment. And like so many beginners, he wasn't able to do that, and he had this kind of grasping or craving mind. And with that kind of grasping mentality, then we are more vulnerable to makyo. And this would really be called a makyo. It's a makyo are mental or physical effects, unusual mental or physical effects from doing hard zazen. He said, "My master was moved with compassion for me. I then wrapped a shawl around my shoulder and prayed mournfully and with great sincerity before the Bodhisattva Vado." This is some guardian figure making this vow. "This affliction must be a karmic debt which I owe from a previous life and which I must pay back in this life. But in order that I may complete this retreat, I beg you to postpone it to a later date. Before you as a witness, I promise to pay this debt after the meditation practice. And I also promise to recite the Huayan Sutra 10 times to show my gratitude and thankfulness to you." I've never heard of this Bodhisattva Vado. So I made my vow. Then, feeling very tired, I went to bed that evening, not even waking when the time for meditation was over. The next day, the master asked, "How is your sickness?" I answered, "I don't feel anything wrong now." He then looked at my back and found that the carbuncle had healed. All the monks were moved with admiration and astonishment, and so I was able to complete the retreat. This thing I don't at all believe is him stretching the truth. The intimate connection between the mind and the body is one that is being more and more accepted in medicine. And remarkable things can happen. The power of faith, that kind of devotion, single-mindedly applied, anything is possible. This is a time when people were more simple-minded and less skeptical. And this, of course, is a great asset in any matter of faith. When the retreat ended, I still felt as if I were in meditation all the time, even while walking through the bazaar or on a busy street. When I was 21, I attended lectures on the Fa Hua Sutra given by Master Wu Qi. I had decided to go far away for a meditation period and was looking for a suitable companion, but had not found the right person. One day, however, I met a traveling monk named Miao Feng, who seemed to be an unusual and genuine person. But a few days later, he left the monastery without my knowing it. Presumably, he feared that a too close association with me might hinder his freedom. It's interesting that he interpreted, that Han Shan interpreted that departure that way. He may have been right. But this Miao Feng will reappear later in this account. When I was 26 years old, a very heavy snow had fallen that year, and I had become very ill. After being sick for some time, I had to beg for food in the street, but no one gave me anything. I wondered, why will no one give me any food? Suddenly, I became aware that I still had some money in my pocket. I then collected all the Buddhist and Taoist monks who had been unable to find food in the snow, and I bought them dinner in an eating house, spending all the money I had. The next morning, when I went to the bazaar again, I had no difficulty in begging and obtaining food. I was so delighted that I exclaimed to myself, "Now my strength is sufficient to counter the weight of hundreds of tons." When I was 29, I came across Miao Feng again in the capital. And he mentions here that, just to paraphrase here, that he and Miao Feng enlisted the support of a patron who paid them to make a block printing of a certain book I never heard of. And in this book, he said, I had difficulty in understanding the thesis, the name of that was On Immutability, especially the part about the whirlwind and the resting mountain. This was a part that he says he had had doubts, about for some years. And in this part, an aged Brahmin, this is from an Indian source, clearly, an aged Brahmin returns home after his lifetime as a monk and hears his neighbors exclaim, "Oh, look, the man of old days still exists." And he replied, "Oh, no, I may look like that old man, but actually, I am not he." This time, when I reached that passage, I suddenly was awakened. So, apparently that those words, "I may look like him, but I am not he," expressing as they do the truth of no self, came at just the right time, and to bring Han Shan to awaken to this truth of no self. The ordinary person drags through his or her life a picture of themselves, a picture based on an image or thoughts or memories, based on how people have responded to the person, reacted to the person, and all of this builds up a self-image or ego that we then carry with us. But the truth is, that there is no substantial. There is no self in any permanent substantial way. It's just a kind of a way that we habitually picture ourselves. That's the self. It's nothing more than that. It's images. It's an image and a cluster of thoughts and memories. And suddenly, Han Shan saw that, experienced it for himself. And he reports here, "I said to myself, in reality, all dharmas," which means all things, "all phenomena, have no coming and no going. Oh, how true this is. I left my seat immediately and made a prostration before the Buddha. As I did this, I felt nothing moves or arises. This is the other side of our ordinary, the world of appearances as we ordinarily see it. Everything is moving, coming and going, changing, evolving and devolving, growing, aging, decaying, passing away, rising and falling. That's just half of reality. There's this backside that the ordinary person never sees, where, yes, in the midst of all of this movement, all of this flux of phenomena, there is that which is unchanging, unmoving, perfectly still, silent. He says, I then lifted up the curtain on the door and stood on the platform outside. A sudden gust of wind swept the trees in the courtyard, whirling leaves against the sky. But while I watched the flying leaves, I felt that nothing was moving. This, I thought to myself, is the meaning of the whirlwind and the resting mountain. Oh, now I understand. Later, even while passing urine, I did not feel that there was anything flowing. I said to myself, oh, this is what is meant by the saying that rivers flow all day, but nothing flows. From that time on, the problems of life and death were completely broken. Thereupon, I composed the following verse. Life comes and death goes. The water flows and the flower withers. Ah, today I know my nostrils are facing downwards. The second morning after this experience, Miao Feng came in. As soon as he saw me, he exclaimed with delight, "What have you found?" "Last evening," I said, "I saw two iron oxen fighting with each other along the river bank until they both fell into the water. Since then, I haven't heard anything of them." Miao Feng smiled. "Congratulations," he said. "You have seized the means by which you can afford to dwell on the mountain from now on." I saw two iron oxen fighting with each other along the river bank until they both fell into the water. He realized for himself that all dualisms are just constructs of the mind, that underneath all of these dualisms, life and death, right and wrong, good and bad, success and failure, light and darkness, all of them, underneath them, there is just this one mind that gives rise to these different concepts. This is awakening, seeing this truth of not to. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.